I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is outstanding Jewish guitarist Rebbe Sol. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our Two Jewish Mavina on Israel, Oshrat Barel, and our Maven on Jewish Education, John Ben Asher. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. It's midsummer now, which also means it will be Bastille Day this coming week, July 14th, the National Independence Day for the country of France. And wouldn't it be nice to be vacationing in France right about now? So close your eyes, unless you're driving right now, and think, if you would, for a moment about France. The Arc de Triomphe, the bridges over the Seine, the Eiffel Tower, the Louvre, wine, cheese, croissants with jam and coffee, great food, wonderful art, lovely countryside, bicycle riders, the language itself is music, a tricolor flag, beautiful cities, and very rude people. You know, France. Far from the heat of a Western summer, just for Bastille Day. Well, you ask, Rabbi, what possible Jewish meaning can all this prattle about France have? Ah, I say, you probably don't know this, but the very first nation in the Old World that guaranteed full citizenship to Jews was revolutionary France. And without the French Revolution of 1789, Jewish history in Europe would have been very, very different. We are grateful to our own country of America, whose 4th of July we celebrated last week, but we should retain some respect for the country that created the very first Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and which benefited our people, the Jews in particular. My favorite weird historical question that most people don't know is this one. Who broke down the walls of the ghettos of Europe, walls that had existed since the 1500s? Who was it that emancipated the Jews of Western Europe? The answer? Napoleon Bonaparte. You see, when Napoleon was conquering Europe in the 1790s and early 1800s, his armies were fighting, at least in theory, for liberty, equality, and fraternity. He had no love for religion, and certainly not for the old order of the Roman Catholic Church that had enforced so many rules and constraints on Jews throughout the Middle Ages and the Renaissance and well into early modern times. While Napoleon had no particular regard one way or the other for Jews, he was a non-com officer from the island of Corsica, and he'd had little exposure to Jews. Still, he had a very strong sense of the necessity to break down the ancien regime, the old bad order. As he said, to the Jews as a commune, that is, a people, nothing. But to the Jew as an individual citizen of France, all rights and privileges. This marked a very great change and a great gift at that time in the world in particular. As the French armies crossed Europe, conquering, plundering, and establishing their own governments everywhere, they also, almost as an afterthought, broke down the walls of every single ghetto they encountered, and they let the Jews out. And they established, at least for some period of time, a new legal system, the Code Napoleon, which allowed Jews to go to university for the first time, to serve in the military, to be part of the civil service, to live wherever they wanted, to live as full citizens. It was an extraordinarily important moment in Jewish history. France enabled us to enter the modern world, at least wherever its armies had sway, and the ghetto walls were never established in quite the same way or with quite the same force, not again, until Hitler. That meant that we Jews suddenly could experience everything the modern world had to offer, and it made possible the extraordinary successes and accomplishments, the experiences of modernity in Judaism. It was while Napoleon-controlled Germany that Reform Judaism was born, an Enlightenment form of Jewish belief and practice that catalyzed all modern Judaism, either inspired by Reform Judaism or in reaction against it. In the long run, it made possible Zionism and the State of Israel. It was earth-shaking. And it was all because of France. Nowadays, you're likely to hear a great deal of anti-French rhetoric in Jewish circles. There is anti-Semitism there. The Muslim immigrants perpetrate anti-Semitic acts against Jews. They, as a nation, often support the Arabs and so on. Many French Jews have even purchased apartments in Israel as a protection for the rise of this Muslim anti-Semitism in France, especially in Netanya, by the way. We have also had very well-publicized and horrible attacks on the Jewish community in France at the Hyper-Kasher supermarket not terribly long ago, as we've seen number of French Muslims enroll in ISIS and go off to fight in Syria and come back radicalized. But the truth about Jewry in France is that it's a much more nuanced picture than that. France remains the largest Jewish community in all of Europe, Paris, the largest Jewish population of any city, and it retains a vital communal life. A recent past president, Nicolas Sarkozy, had Jewish ancestors and did a terrific job countering anti-Semitism and improving Holocaust education, as well as building up the French relationship with Israel. The current president, François Hollande, has continued that work. We retain hope that Jewish life in France, which has flourished since Roman times, will continue to be vibrant and vital. Bastille Day also provides us with a wonderful excuse to play a comedy cut from one of our all-time favorite Jewish comedians, the late and very great Alan Sherman. Here's a special tribute to France and Bastille Day itself, when the French overthrew the tyranny of King Louis XVI and entered the modern world. It's called You Went the Wrong Way, Old King Louis.
Louis XVI was the King of France in 1789. He was worse than Louis XV. He was worse than Louis XIV. He was worse than Louis XIII. He was the worst since Louis I. King Louis was living like a king, but the people were living rotten. So the people, they started an uprising, which they called the French Revolution. And of course, you remember their battle cry, which will never be forgotten. You went the wrong way, old King Louis. You made the population cry, 'cause all you did was sit and pet with Marie Antoinette in your place at Versailles. And now the country's gone kablooey, so we are giving you the air that ought to teach you not to spend all your time fooling round at the Folies Bergère. If you had been a nicer king, we wouldn't do a thing, but you were bad, you must admit. We're gonna take you and the queen down to the guillotine and shorten you a little bit. You came the wrong way, old King Louis, and now you ain't got far to go. Too bad you won't be here to see that great big Eiffel Tower or Brigitte Bardot. To you, King Louis, we say fooey. You disappointed all of France, but then what else could we expect from a king in silk stockings and pink satin pants? You filled your stomach with chop suey and also crepe Suzette's and steak. And when they told your wife Marie that nobody had bread, she said, let them eat cake. We're gonna take you and the queen down to the guillotine. It's somewhere in the heart of town. And when that fella there is through with what he's gonna do, you'll have no place to wear your crown. You You came the wrong way, old King Louie. Now we must put you on the shelf. That's why the people are revolting, 'cause Louie, you're pretty revolting yourself.
Ah, never let it be said that Too Jewish doesn't provide the finest in sophisticated Jewish culture at all times and seasons. That was Alan Sherman's You Went the Wrong Way, Old King Louie, a fitting capstone to our Bastille Day commemoration here on Too Jewish and our mini history of French and really European Jewry. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish, Rebbe Sol, is a wonderful musician who came to his Jewish roots by a very interesting and surprising path. Hear how he found his neshama, his own Jewish musical soul, when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish. We welcome John Ben Asher, head of school for Tucson Hebrew Academy. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Rabbi Kohan.
Tell us about THA.
THA is an incredible school, rich community, strong educational culture. We're a K-8 program and Tucson's only Jewish day school.
With small classes, really a tremendous level of individual attention.
Absolutely. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supporting learning environment for kids.
And those kids go on to succeed academically. This isn't just about Jewish identity.
THA graduates go on to Tucson's best high schools, and they are exceptionally well prepared.
And I've seen some of them go to Ivy League schools, some of the best colleges in the country too, if that's important for parents, which I believe it is.
That's right. THA really paves the way for students. A rich, strong academic foundation, as well as Jewish knowledge, learning, and culture.
And great community. How can people find out more about putting their kids in THA?
You can come visit or find us online, thaaz.org, and give us a call, 529-3888.
That's 529-3888, or visit www.thaaz.org. To play in our guest this morning, here's a bit of his own beautiful rendition of Moishele's Niggun. To Jewish, our guest this morning, he's Rebbe Sol, a remarkable and I think unique Jewish performer and one of the really tremendous guitarists I personally have ever heard, and not bad on a balalaika. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So you told a story in concert at the Privilege of Hearing about how you got into Jewish music. You were obviously Jewish. You were a studio musician in L.A. Tell us how that came about.
Yeah, well, I was a musician and I and a guitar player in L.A. You're in like 15, 20 bands at the same time. You're playing with all these different artists, and you sound different all the time because in recordings, you basically do what is needed to be done for the project. And at one point, I just wanted my own sound, and I found it in my roots by I was invited to like a Shabbat dinner by. The Lubavitchers, the Chabad people.
Was this Shlomo Schwartz who did this?
Schwartzy was, if it wasn't that exact one, it was certainly
somebody
one of them.
Like him, anyway, a Chabadnik.
Yeah. Okay. And I've been to many of his sure. Shabbat tables. And the one where I actually thought of writing that song, Sister Sarah, which is on my first album, that was actually at his Shabbat dinner, and it was one of the very, very first, if not the first. And what happened was... there were just a whole group of people. It was like this massive dinner. And at the very, very beginning, the women, got up, and there must have been, 15 of them or something. And they were all lighting the candles and singing the bracha, and it was just really touching. And I just thought of this idea for writing a song about it, and I called it Sister Sarah. And that was the very beginning of the whole project.
So your voice became very clearly a Jewish voice, so much so that you eventually made Aliyah. You take typical
not, I don't know, typical, but Jewish melodies that are familiar to many people, and then you just kind of go to town on them musically. I don't know if that's a fair description of some of your stuff. How would you describe it?
Well, actually, yeah, that's not too bad. My compliments. Basically, when I first started this, you know, first of all, I'm a musician first. I'm not a rabbi that picked up a guitar later and felt like I'm so inspired, all I have to do is just, you know, play this guitar, these three chords.
And the neshama will come through the three chords,
yeah,
right.
Yeah, and that, you know, kind of only goes so far. So, so one of the things, at least I think, that made this unique at the very beginning is, like, here's a real musician doing some of these songs, and, you know, they're not terribly complicated, you know, but there's a certain amount of soul in them, and if they're played by, like, a real musician who plays it, you know, honestly from his heart, and doesn't try to overdo it and overarrange it like what a lot of, let's say, not experienced players might do, it's going to sound good. And so that's the reason why I think, you know, my earliest stuff, when it first came out, it was on the radio and everything, because no one had really heard anything like that before.
It's great stuff. We'll hear some samples, and we'll talk much more with Rebbe Soul when we come back in a few moments here on Two Jewish.
We welcome our friends David and Pamela from Freedom Smoke. Good morning.
Hey,
good morning.
Rabbi.
Quitting smoking, big part of your lives.
Yeah, it's very important. When we started this company just over 6 years ago, it was because I had a really bad cigar habit, and it was time for me to quit. We have 7 children. Our youngest just turned 8, and I wish to be around to watch them all grow up and have successful careers and family of their own.
And Pamela, it's better personally, isn't it?
Yeah, most definitely. I'm a non-smoker, and being with a person who smokes cigars in particular, it's much nicer. His body doesn't reek of it, his hair does not reek of it, his clothes do not smell of it, and there's no tobacco between his teeth anymore.
And you don't have to send them for extra showers or
no,
out in the rain.
No extra
smoke.
Showers.
How can people find out more about Freedom Smoke?
You can look us up on our website at freedomsmokeusa.com or call us on our toll-free number, 1-800-705-7013. That's 800-705-7013.
Thanks so much.
Thanks,
Thank
Rabbi.
You.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O Jewish Radio 18. Or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website, stream us from there, or download us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. We have 4 months until we elect a new president of these United States, and so we continue with our 2016 Two Jewish Presidential Report. In the latest case, exemplifying the tension between Israel's rabbinate and Orthodox groups in the diaspora, a religious court prevented the marriage of an Israeli man and an American woman who converted under a well-respected New York rabbi, Rabbi Haskell Lookstein. And in a twist which has brought this case into the limelight, Rabbi Lookstein was the one who converted Ivanka Trump and officiated at her wedding to Jewish real estate scion Jared Kushner, an advisor to presumptive Republican nominee Donald Trump. The woman in the case converted under Rabbi Lookstein in the U.S., but was prevented from marrying her Israeli fiancé as the court decided she was not Jewish or not Jewish enough. The Rabbanut, the Orthodox Israeli rabbinate, controls personal status matters in the country, including marriages and funerals, and has traditionally not accepted conversions done in the Reform or conservative streams of Judaism. In recent years, the religious authority, the Rabbanut, has also targeted conversions by Orthodox rabbis not on its list of approved authorities. That list has never been made public. The irony is that this woman is very meticulous about religious observance. She is as Jewish as I am, as Jewish as the rabbis signed on the certificate, except in the eyes of the Petah Tikva rabbinate, Rabbi Lookstein said. Israel's education minister, Naftali Bennett, a member of the right-wing religious Jewish Home Party, slammed the Rabbanut's ruling. The rabbinical court's decision is arbitrary and odd. It must be reversed. Rabbi Lookstein is one of the leading and most appreciated Orthodox rabbis in the U.S., Naftali Bennett said. This mistake must be repaired immediately. We couldn't agree more, and perhaps Ivanka Trump agrees too. That was our 2016 presidential election from a Jewish perspective update. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking about identity and the way in which we form attachments and our need for community and small community. One of the things that I've been playing with, and we've talked about this a little bit along the way, is the way Jewish identity is changing in 2016, where you used to think about Jewish identity in one way, and now you walk into a synagogue and you'll see people who are African-American and or Asian, Latino, gay, straight, Jews by choice, come back to Judaism. It's a very different community, certainly in the Reform movement.
Right. I was going to say that's true to a much greater extent in some subsets of Judaism than in others.
Now, that you might see that in Chabad, too, actually, in
right.
some of the outreach parts of Orthodoxy,
right.
where you won't see it so much in a conservative synagogue or maybe some mainstream modern Orthodox synagogues. But you do see that a lot now in a way that you never would have seen it 30
right.
years ago. What does that mean for Jewish identity going forward? Is it, I'm not saying whether it's good or bad, it just is, but how does that change the way we think about ourselves?
Well, so you know that by now that I'm a historian and I'm into history. And I think looking at the 19th century is instructive because what happened in Europe in the 19th century was that ghetto walls came down, Jews were quote-unquote emancipated, and they had choices that they had never previously had. So pretty much, at the risk of oversimplifying, prior to 1800, every Jew living in Europe lived in a ghetto that was under lock and key, and every Jew living in Europe was essentially Orthodox. Now, they might have been Hasidish or Misnagdish or whatever, but they were basically
Orthodox.
All following the same calendar, the same laws, the same practices, with slightly different emphases.
And they had to be in the Jewish community because
right.
the other communities wouldn't accept them.
Right. And the few differences that existed among them, they exaggerated and attached great importance to because it was basically a very uniform lifestyle. Well, once the ghetto walls came down and Jews were afforded the opportunity to live where they wanted and pursue whatever professions they wanted and go to non-Jewish universities and become doctors and lawyers, whatever. So new forms of Judaism began and were born, like Reform Judaism and eventually Conservative Judaism, Reconstructionism, whatever. And I think the Jewish community became a lot less unified. And certain historians, at least, would argue that one of the factors in history that allowed the Holocaust to happen was the lack of unity that resulted from the emancipation. So there's a guy named David Vital who wrote a great book called A People Apart,
yeah.
whose main argument is that the fractiousness and the lack of unity among the Jewish communities of Europe prevented them from being as effective in their own behalf, in their self-defense, in 1940 than they were in 1740.
Yeah, isn't that
stunning?
He
makes a really strong case. So today, I think we rarely see what we used to see, even in my childhood. You know, 50 years ago, there would be Jewish community-wide Thanksgiving services with Orthodox, Conservative, and Reform Jews sitting together and praying together on a secular holiday. You don't see that anymore.
No, and there's a reason. You know, there's been a real polarization within the Jewish community. We don't pull together in the same way.
Right. And I mean, I think that is an example of loss of affiliation and loss of identity and loss of attachment that was once a cohesive and positive thing when like all Jews cared about each other. Now it's you care about your own subgroup, but not necessarily all about the whole Jewish community.
So it's a form of tribalism that's a little too tribal.
Yeah.
Tom, we will talk next week. Thanks so much.
I look forward to it.
We welcome our Mivinon, Israel Oshrat Bariel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
So there was an old line in the early days of Israel that said that Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, and Haifa were very different. You could sum it up in one phrase.
Tel Aviv, you go to dance. Jerusalem, you go to study. And Haifa, you go to work.
Right, and of course in Hebrew it rhymes, right?
Yes, Haifa, בחיפה עובדים, בתל אביב רוקדים, בירושלים לומדים.
Right, right. And sometimes they said, you know, you sort of like Jerusalem was the place you went to pray, Tel Aviv to play, and Haifa, nothing rhymes with that, work. But they really are different cities. We think about Israel as all one place. Not true at all.
Yeah, it's a one small place, but there is a huge difference between Haifa in the north, which is really the place, it's a port city, and there is a lot of all kind of chemical factories. So
a lot of industry.
A lot of industry, which a lot of pollution. But it's right, a little bit of, but
it's also got the Technion, so it has a lot of high tech has sort of spun up around there. Not like Tel Aviv, but still.
Yes.
And the other part that nobody realizes about Haifa is it's got beautiful beaches and it looks like San Francisco.
Mamash.
Except, you know, it's high hills and green and it's really quite gorgeous.
And not to mention the Germany colony and the Baha'im there.
Right, and down from the Baha'i, they built this whole beautiful, new, wonderful restaurant and theater and stuff.
But still, people will think about Haifa as a workplace,
right.
Definitely. Tel Aviv, even though you have high tech and you have a lot of modern, like Yadut Mitkademet, modern.
Well, new industries and
no, Yadut Mitkademet, which
oh,
is.
Oh, I'm sorry. Progressive Judaism, actually, right. That's
but
where
no
the.
No one will think
Beit
about
Daniel
Tel Aviv.
And lots of other places, right?
Exactly. No one will think about Tel Aviv as a place to go to Bet Midrash, right?
Right.
But it's what I'm trying to say that you have everything in Tel Aviv and Haifa and Jerusalem, but still people would think
about
Tel Aviv.
Yeah, even though there's great universities in Tel Aviv, but still, Nahon. Tel Aviv is the place where you can go out and find a great place to party at 3 in the morning. Any night of the year.
Yes, and in Tucson, you will come back from Bilui, to go out with your wife or with your family, like 9, 10, 11.
The
in
streets
Tel Aviv,
are closed. Right.
You only get dressed in right. 11 or 12.
You go out to dinner at 11 o'clock.
And then you call and book your restaurant for yeah. 1 a.m.
1 a.m. Like, yeah, I'll eat on the boardwalk across from the ocean at 1 a.m. in Tel Aviv.
Rabbi, after 3 years here, when I was in Israel a few months ago, and when I was on my way to the hotel at 12 a.m. and I saw people out, I said, really? It's mm-hmm. Monday. It's like, you don't have work tomorrow? Like, so it's funny.
Totally very different.
And Jerusalem can be very, you know, you can find a lot of chic and beautiful nightclubs in Jerusalem, but no one will, like when you plan your trip to Israel, you don't think of a nightclub in Jerusalem. You think of the Kotel, the tunnels, whatever,
the holy sites, yeah. the great synagogues, right?
Bidiyuk, not a nightclub, not a fancy club.
Not a fancy restaurant,
not a fancy
although
bar
there's great
in Mamila
restaurants.
Hotel, which they have.
They do, yes, that's correct. Along the whole Mamila walk, there's plenty of places to go.
Yes.
Or Emek Rephaim is a ton of great restaurants. But you're right, they're really different qualities. And maybe next time we'll talk about an emerging city in Israel that nobody used to talk about, possibly Be'er Sheva. Thanks, Feshrat. We'll talk next week.
Toda.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Geropsych specializes in providing short-term, inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
We welcome our maven on Jewish education, John Ben Asher, head of the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Good morning, John. Boker Tov.
Boker Or.
There are times when, as educators and as parents who are really educators, horim, the Hebrew word for parents, is the same one as moreh, teacher.
Right, teacher.
We have to talk to our kids about very hard things that are going on in society.
Sure.
A month ago, the horrible Orlando massacre.
Right.
What wisdom do you bring to that process? And in a school setting, of course, it's a little different than at home.
Yeah, schools have a very important role to play when tragedy hits. And, you know, part of life is walking through tragedy. It doesn't always happen on a big scale like we saw in Florida recently. You know, in our hearts And our prayers and our thoughts go out to all of those victims and families. And I think as Jews, we have a special connection to people who are victimized, because sometimes we are the ultimate victim. But at any rate, you know, tragedy pops up. It can be the loss of a pet, which is huge for a 6-year-old, a 12-year-old, even adults. You know, and in families, people lose siblings, people lose parents, grandparents, friends. So death is part of living and part of the experience. So what do you do at school?
Yeah, so what do you do? I mean,
yeah.
You know, I think not too long ago, there was a girl my daughter went to camp with who happened to die of heat stroke on a trip to Israel. You know, really tragic, Arizona girl. How do you talk to her?
As we've talked over the months on the radio together, you know, you hear me talk about developmentally appropriate strategies and approaches. The conversation that you have with a 5-year-old is different than the conversation that you have with a 14-year-old. And so teachers have a lot of experience in knowing what's developmentally appropriate with kids. And so schools have kind of a whole battery of support levels. And the messaging essentially is as follows. We talk about the truth. We talk about appropriate factual information. So for example, 5-year-olds don't need to know some of the really intense nitty-gritty details about what happened in Orlando. How many died? How many were shot? How did it all happen? But older kids might already have that information. They're on the internet. They're talking to each other about what's going on in the world. So they probably already have a lot of information. So talking with kids about the facts at an age-appropriate level is one component. It's important because you acknowledge what's happened. You don't ignore. You don't gloss over it. You don't act like nothing has occurred. So acknowledging and talking about some factual information is a piece of it. And then giving kids a chance to ask questions, to express how they feel to a degree is important too. And teachers also are very cautious about monitoring the conversation and knowing, you know, is the next question one too many? Are the kids, you know, are the feelings a little too intense? Do we need to soften the conversation? And then after processing the facts and the feelings, doing something, making some kind of statement together as a group, that sort of community response. It could be sending flowers, sending food, lighting a candle, writing letters, all kinds of ways to show that we're here with you. So taking some action is important too, and it gives a sense of closure and a sense of capacity that I can do something with this. I don't have to suffer as a victim. I can do something. I can take an action. And
That empowerment is so critical.
Absolutely. And we also have a school counselor who's available.
So having a professional to refer to.
Having a professional and having people with training and background, just very huge.
John, thanks so much. Difficult subject and a serious approach. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
When we return on To Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Two bees meet in a field. One says to the other, "How are things?" "Really bad," says the second bee. "The weather's cold, wet, and damp. There aren't any flowers. I can't make honey." "Oh, no problem," says the first bee. "Just fly down 5 blocks and turn left. Keep going until you see a lot of cars. There's a bar mitzvah going on. There are all kinds of fresh flowers there." "Hey, thanks for the tip," says the second bee and flies away. An hour later, the two bees run into each other again. The first bee says, "So, how'd it go?" "Great," says the second bee. "It was everything you said. There were huge floral arrangements on every table." "Great, great," says the first bee. "But what's that on your head?" "Oh," says the second bee, "that's my yarmulke. I didn't want them to think I was a wasp." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Balak in the Book of Numbers, which includes some of the best words an outsider ever delivered about our people. In the portion, one of just two in the whole Torah named after a non-Jew, 40 years of wandering have passed, and the Israelites now finally arrive on the borders of the land of Canaan. They're about to move in and seem unstoppable to their opponents. Balak, the king of Moab, comes up with a novel plan. He will hire Balaam, a pagan sorcerer, to curse the Israelites, which will destroy their chances of defeating his own army and entering the land. But the scheme doesn't work. Balaam may be a polytheistic prophet, but he is also an honest man who conveys only what God permits him to say. After consulting the Almighty, Balaam agrees to do the deed, but only if God allows him to do so. And so we're given the intriguing spectacle of Balaam the sorcerer three times trying to curse the people of Israel, only to find that the words that come out of his mouth are not curses, but blessings. The last of these orations is a text that's become the prayer we use whenever we enter a synagogue. Ma tovu ohalecha Yaakov, how good are your tents, Jacob, your homes, Israel. Somehow, the best laid plans of Israel's enemies go awry, transformed by the hand of God. Without being too deterministic, we know that in recent decades, many nations and organizations have planned the destruction of our people and of our country, Israel. Although their efforts have injured us, we ultimately have triumphed. Perhaps more importantly, the personal message of this portion of Balak is subtle. Usually, the way it works in life is we intend to bring blessing, but bring tsoras, trouble, instead. But if we rely on God's help and inspiration, we'll find that even our less than nobly motivated actions can bring blessing in the place of curses. It's all a matter of remembering the true source for inspiration and creativity, and therefore blessing, which is God. When we come back on To Jewish, our guest, Rebbe Sol, will explore the ways he creates a uniquely personal form of Jewish music at a high level when we return in a moment on To Jewish.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays, I do yoga. Wednesdays, we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursday is my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life. 322-7035.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
The head of England's Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn, already having suffered a vote of no confidence and a demand from party members that he step down as its chair, has now apologized for calling radical Islamist groups, Hezbollah and Hamas, his friends. He has also denounced the remarks of Ken Livingstone, the former mayor of London and a key member of the Labour Party, that Hitler was a supporter of Zionism, as utterly absurd. Corbyn has also insisted that Labour does not foster anti-Semitism, despite the suspensions of a number of party members because of their anti-Jewish comments. Relations between England and Israel continue to be strained in the wake of a reported effort by British police to question Israeli Knesset member Tzipi Livni during a visit to London for alleged war crimes when she was Israel's foreign minister in 2008 during the conflict with Hamas. The Israeli Foreign Ministry has stated that it viewed these efforts with great concern and would engage British authorities until the matter was resolved. Here in this country, the so-called Stargate controversy continues between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton after the Trump campaign printed an ad depicting Clinton looking for money behind a Jewish star. Trump's campaign has insisted that the star was a sheriff's badge and had nothing to do with Jews remove the star. Finally, the entire world has mourned the recent death of Elie Wiesel. Among the numerous tributes from near and far is this one by the noted lawyer and Harvard professor Alan Dershowitz. Elie Wiesel did more to bring the word human into human rights than any person in modern history. For him, it did not matter whether the victims of genocide were Jews, Christians, Muslims, black, white, from the left, or from the right. The world will miss Elie Wiesel for as long as the quest for justice continues. And that's the Two Jewish News.
We're delighted to welcome back the Two Jewish. Our guest this morning is the outstanding guitarist, Jewish musician, Rebbe Sol. We started talking earlier about what inspired you and your approach to the music that you use. You've covered people like Shlomo Carlebach and other... Is there a particular Jewish musician or composer that you like, or do you just get inspired by ideas? What's the best way to get into your neshama, your musical neshama?
It's probably, you know, a lot of the traditional stuff. I wouldn't say it's any one person. Like Shlomo Carlebach, for example, I would say one of his greatest assets is probably not even his musical ability. He was an amazing storyteller.
Incredible.
You know, I mean, just unbelievable. And he knew how to teach a lesson, and he knew how to tell a story in order to teach a lesson. And the songs, it was almost like a byproduct of the thing. And they were very simple melodies, but most great melodies are simple melodies. So they're really terrific, you know. Perhaps a lot of our great Jewish people had different skills like that. Like Zalman Schechter also was very musical and knew a lot about music, and also could tell a great story.
Great storyteller, too. Absolutely. Yeah. You play a balalaika tuned very unusually. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah, so the balalaika, this was given to me as a gift. It came from Tommy Tedesco. Who was a really
famous studio musician.
Right.
Yeah. And if studio musicians ever get to be famous, he was really
great. Yeah, he was, yeah. Usually they're all behind the scenes. No one knows about him. And frankly, a lot of people don't know about him either. But if you've watched TV, you've probably heard him play, you know. So the balalaika, it ultimately came from him. He actually picked it out, gave it to a girlfriend of mine at the time who gave it to me. That's kind of how it got to me. But anyway, I had no idea like how to tune, how to play. And in those days, there was no internet. I'm in L.A. even, which is, you know, a big city with a lot of music stuff. I started going around all these music stores. I couldn't find anything about balalaikas. And I remember I talked to Tommy, and I said, how do you tune this thing? He says, I don't know. I just tune it like a guitar.
which is not correct, actually.
Right. And so then I figure, okay, I'll do that, but like, where do I start? You know, which string is it, and what's the pitch? You know, is it too high, too low? So I just kind of randomly picked something, and I decided to go kind of on the low side, because when you have really loose strings, even though they're very difficult to keep in tune, there's a kind of an exotic weirdness you can get with it, and I have my balalaika right here, and I'll show you what I'm talking about. Like, you could play a note like this, very straight up,
yeah.
But I could also do like that, and if you have loose strings that are low, you can do that a lot more easily, so it suddenly makes it like really, really cool, you know, like, you know, and that
sounds incredibly Jewish and also really interesting and rich and Middle Eastern somehow.
Yeah, it's almost like a compromise between an oud, and there are even some Far Eastern instruments where they have kind of like a bridge where the string is very, very elevated, and they push down on the string so they can get it to bend like this. And I forgot the name of some of them, but it's in the Far East, like in China.
Sure.
and Cambodia and places like that. They play these, and they sound really, really cool. So I just like the sound, and so I can still do the, you know, like some of the Russian stuff anyway by doing the tremolos. But this gives me an opportunity to do that, and plus, I already know how to play a guitar.
You didn't have to relearn.
So I play those chords, by God, and they just sort of work out.
And you use it. You use the balalaika actually as a kind of guitar replacement on some stuff, don't you?
Right, and I use it to supplement guitars. Like for example, on recordings, I'll use... a lot of times in recording, there's something called Nashville tuning. Nashville tuning, you take a... Sometimes it's even a 12-string guitar, but a lot of times it's a 6-string, and you put on thin strings, and you tune them up like an octave in certain places, so it gives it a real high-pitch kind of thing, and you overlay that, or you overdub that on top of a strumming guitar track, and it gives it a nice sheen and a nice kind of a body. It's really pretty. And with a balalaika, I sort of use that in the same way that I might use Nashville tuning and recording sometimes. I'll play, you know, some guitar parts or have some, you know, some, keyboards or whatever. And then on top of it, I'll just play the chords on the balalaika in a certain way, like I'll arpeggiate them, which is, you know, like, like that, as opposed to, which is strumming them. Right. And it gives it a nice texture and the pitch and the tonic personality, sonic personality of it. Is different enough so it complements it in the same way that Nashville tuning might do something like that too.
So tell us how the name Rebbe Soul came about.
So Rebbe Soul, when I first started doing this, I was kind of searching for my sound, as I said earlier, and I found it in my roots, and I realized, okay, well, these are Jewish roots, and I was looking around, there aren't really other artists doing this. Or at least of any kind of quality. I mean, you can always sing around the campfire and do stuff like that,
sure,
of course. But for something that's more serious, I really wasn't hearing much at that time. So I was thinking, you know, there's something mystical about this too, because it seems to me like it's more than just playing music. You know, if you're a sincere musician, maybe even just a sincere artist in general, the best thing that we can do is just to get out of the way. You know, you practice, you get your skills together, and you get them together enough, and you become accomplished enough, so that when it comes time to really play, you kind of let something come through you. You're almost like a channel, you know? And so that's the way I saw it. And the Rebbes in the Jewish tradition were people that essentially personified that. They were the kind of people that sort of seemed to just have a connection somehow. People would go to them to seek advice or whatever, because they seemed connected, and they seemed to be connected in many ways, and also to the people themselves, which was really important. That was kind of the person you could talk to about your problems. And I saw music and the way you know, you play, if you're really being honest and you kind of step aside, that's essentially what we're doing. So I immediately thought, wow, it's like the Rebbes. And it just comes right to your soul. It's from your soul. It goes just like a nigun, you know, the wordless melody. You know, traditionally in Hasidic tradition, they say the nigun is so healthy because it goes from your heart right to heaven. And that's kind of the same thing with this music, I think. So, you know, we kind of step aside, we get out of the way, and so we're like, you know, the Rebbes, and there's this soul element. And the words just kind of stuck together, and that's kind of how it happened.
How do you decide what melody to play next?
To record or whatever. Okay, so generally, when I first started doing this, as I said, this is before the internet, you couldn't go on and just listen to a bunch of things. It was really hard to find this stuff.
Right.
And so what I did is, first, on the first album, I just took a couple of melodies from my childhood, and I just did those, you know, just, you know... things like that. Just these playful, cute little melodies where I could actually get through the words.
Right.
Because there were, you know, it was only a line or two, you know. So I would do those. And then I thought, you know, this is a really interesting area that I want to get into. So where am I going to find these? And so I started going to libraries and music stores and just looking for books of Jewish music. And I would just buy all the sheet music. And I would just go through the sheet music, and I would run across one that's, oh, that looks good. And I would do it. And generally, I would never have heard anyone do the song before. I remember this happened. One song that I even did tonight was Kol Dodi, which is from Shira Shirin.
Sure.
Okay, so I do it like, Kol Dodi, and that's kind of how I do it, and right. it's sort of lively and rhythmic and whatever. And it's just, I just looked at the melody and I just, you know, played it, and I said, okay, this is the way I think, I just sort of hear it like this, you right. know? And it's a good thing I didn't hear other people do it, because later on, after I recorded it, I heard a couple of other Jewish artists do the song, and I thought, my God, had I heard that, I probably wouldn't have wanted to do it, because they're pro- it's almost, it was almost like this real solemn, it was like this medieval thing,
yeah,
which sure. is cool in its own way, but it's definitely yeah. something that I wouldn't have wanted to do like that.
Sure.
Just for me personally.
Sure.
And so,
so sometimes ignorance is really a gift.
It is bliss for me. Absolute bliss.
Musical bliss. Right. In this case.
So, but that's it. But I really went through sheet music, and I found tons of stuff that way. Let's see, most of the stuff came from that, and then eventually with the internet I was able to hear things, but now I almost prefer not to hear some of the stuff. I just kind of, you know, find the music or...
And then see how it feels.
Yeah.
It sounds like to you.
Right. One of the most interesting experiences I had, when I was in Israel this was maybe a year or two ago, there's up in the north in the Galil, there's an Arab oud player, his name is George Siman. So he plays oud, and like a lot of oud players, he plays violin and saz and a few things. And he's not Jewish, but he does a lot of Jewish stuff as well. He does all kinds of different things. And
that's the majority culture, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of it, you know. But he does, you know, like songs of Islam, probably Sufi songs, all sure. kinds of different things.
Sure.
And he's a total sweetheart of a guy. I was introduced to him, and I was talking to him, and I remember... he plays with a lot of Israeli artists, and I told him, George, you know, I don't think you don't have anything of your own, do you really? And you play with all these people, and he said, well, no, I don't really have much. I said, you know, I'm gonna produce a couple of tracks for you. I'm just gonna do it just on my own, whatever, and just so you have something. So since he played with so many people, it was easy to find, you know, all these Israeli artists that love him, you know, whether they're Jews or Christians or, you know,
sure.
Muslims or whatever.
Sure.
So I found Yuval Banai. He's in a big band there called Machina.
Machina, yeah.
Right. Sure. They're like the Rolling Stones of Israel.
Kind of, know? Yeah.
and they've
been around a while.
Yeah, they sure have. And of course, you know, I didn't have to do much to talk him into it because he loves George. So we got together up in the Galil. George has a wonderful place up there, which overlooks this valley. And I brought all this portable recording equipment. And he started doing the song. It was Shalom Leven Dodi. Mm-hmm. And I knew the song. And how did I know it? Because I had the sheet music years ago. And I remember looking at it. And here I'm hearing this guy doing it. I said, oh, I know the song. And so, I had both of them sing it. You know, there was some Arabic. There was some Hebrew. And they both kind of switched on and off and back and forth and did harmonies. George played oud. And I think I played like... I even put in some heavy metal guitar because Yuval in the rock band, you know, I thought it would have been an appropriate match.
Sure.
And it was one of the most fun experiences. And so that's the kind of thing that can develop when you just sort of explore these things in whatever way you do, as opposed to hearing someone and you just say, oh, I'm just going to do it like that again.
What a great freedom. And also what a wonderful message that music can carry across all
right.
these cultures and religious experiences to mean something really universal.
Especially, and that song in particular, Shalom Leven Dodi, it means like peace to you, my cousin.
Yeah.
And what a perfect song for, like, you know, for
a
Christian Arab to, you know, sing with a, you know, Israeli Jew or
yeah.
whatever. It's so cool, you know.
Totally awesome. I want to thank Rebbe Sol for a great visit here on Too Jewish.
Sure, my pleasure.
Oh, wonderful. People can find out more about your music.
My website is just RebbeSoul.com.
RebbeSoul.com.
Right.
RebbeSoul.com. Thanks again so much.
Thank you.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest and get a final musical play out from Rebbe Sol.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday. Our guest will be Mike Wise, the co-CEO of Honeymoon Israel, a remarkable new program to send newly married couples to Israel. Our playout this morning comes from our guest, Rebbe Sol himself, his version of Tzoma Lecha Nafshi, My Soul Thirsts for You, God. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.